We're going to talk today about Jesus loving women who tried maybe inadvertently to control people or their circumstances. Before we do that, have you ever tried to share Jesus' love with a modern-day controlling woman? Let me tell you about one situation. I got on a plane and, oh, hi, Mike. Come here. I want you to know Mike Haynes. He was at the University of Oklahoma when I was there. I'm so glad you came when I wore this. And when he was there, he had the nerve to have one full page in the yearbook on what, Mike?
Bible studies.
No, that's...
Very good. Thank you. I'm glad you're still after it, Mike. Still writing things for the Navigators. That's thrilling. About this plane trip, I'm sure Mike wishes he were on one now. We moved onto the plane, and I got in a middle seat, which I do not normally enjoy, but I had read this book that indicated that we should look around at the clothing that people were wearing and see if we could spot anything that indicated something they really loved. And then we could draw them from what they loved to the love of God. So I began to look around. You have to do this inconspicuously. But I noticed a pair of wings that this lady was wearing, and her hair was about my color. So I knew that she'd gone into her metallic age, too. You know, silver hair, gold teeth, a lead bottom, and many other things. Put us in that category. So I thought, they only give those things to children. So I said, I bet you're taking that to your grandchild. And I've never known a grandmother that didn't love those grandchildren. And she said, no, I'm not. This is not a toy. I said, she said, I was a pilot in World War II. Yeah, me too. I said, I did not know they had women pilots in World War II. She said, if you read very much, you would know that. And at that time, don't you just want to take back control and go, lady, did you know I used to teach speed reading? But what is the goal, really? The goal is to love them to the love of God. And if you can stay on your goal, so I sat there, as you know, letting her think I didn't know how to read, and tried to figure out what is it about her flying that relates to Christianity. I thought, faith. It takes a great deal of faith to get in those planes, push buttons, and have them go up and think you're going to have them come down where you mean for them to. So I said, could you talk to me about faith and flying? She said, no, I'd rather talk to you about responsibility. I said, well, I don't know how you can talk about one without the other. She said, really? People don't normally question me. And I said, well, I would love to hear you talk about both of them. She said, let me think of it. And so she did. And as she did, I was going to pray for her. But when you're tired, don't shut your eyes when you pray. I fell asleep during this exciting conversation. But she woke me up. She said, I thought about your question. I said, yes, yes. And she said, and she began to talk about faith and responsibility and flying. And as she talked about faith, I thought, now who in Scripture could I bring in? I don't have to use, you know, the verse before and after. Do we, Joyce? And I thought, why don't I bring in Abraham, since he's the father of our faith? And so I started talking about Abraham, and she said, a moment. Don't talk to me about Abraham. I said, no, why not? She said, I've read the Bible. Abraham was a pimp, wasn't he? Yeah. Inside, I was like a Charles Schulz Lucy screaming, don't call him, I'm a pimp! But outwardly, I turned to her and said, how did you get that? I must have missed that in my reading. Yeah. she said, well, didn't he give, I'll take 10, 8 by 10 glossies, and I see. Didn't he give his beautiful wife to that head of state? I said, you know, he did. And then I tried to take up for Abraham. I said, but I don't think he got any pay for it. She said, oh, yes, he did. He got a lot of loot for that. And so I sat instructed by this individual. And finally, I did not know what to say but the truth. And ladies, I don't care who talks to you. If you will stick to the truth, it works. I've heard from John that it sets us free. So I said, you know what? I don't know. I don't know about that. All I know is I guess that God used flawed people back then to get his message out. Just like he's doing today. Do you know that was perfectly all right with her? She began to talk then about God. And as she did, I brought Jesus into the conversation. Because have you ever noticed that people sometimes can talk about God till the cows come home? Whatever that means. I know cows have come to my home. So. But when I mentioned Jesus, she said, you know, you've changed the subject on me. I said, no, I haven't. You're talking about God. I'm talking about Jesus. Jesus is the only way to God. We're talking about the same thing. She said, who told you that? A television evangelist? I'll tell you what I think of television evangelists. And she did for several minutes. And finally, I said, no, it's in the scripture. There's a first question that she's asked me where I could have penetrated her very heart with the scripture. Where is it? She said. Have you ever then sat like you just had a fresh frontal lobotomy? I could not remember John 14:6. And finally had to admit it. Otherwise she thought I'd gone into a coma or something. And I said, you know, I can't think of it right now, but is the Holy Spirit wonderful to us? She reached in her purse and pulled out her card and she said, well, if you ever find that is scripture, will you write me? So God is with us in the midst of controlling women or not. But we want to look at two women that Jesus loved who had a tendency toward control, and consequently he challenged them with his love. Now, I think, do you know the book, The Two Sides of Love by Gary Smalley and John Trent? They talk about the fact that a rose is very much like a two-sided love that we need to cultivate. And I believe Jesus is a beautiful model of that. Because one thing about this rose, did you notice I had it wrapped up? And do you know why? It has thorns on it. If it were totally soft and beautiful, it could be easily crushed. And if it were all thorns, no one would ever enjoy the beauty of it. But it's two-sided, beauty and thorns. And they call this the soft side and the hard side of love. Or some people have called it the tough and tender kind of love. So we want to look at the way Jesus stepped out of the normal and out of the status quo to confront people. Don't you appreciate people who have stepped out and in love challenged your life? I remember when I was working in Fort Worth, and I had met Walt Hendrickson. And he noticed that I was teaching high school English during the day, business English to bankers at 4 o'clock, and then at 7 I would go over to a private college and teach freshman English. That doesn't leave you a lot of time. And Walt said to me one time, in love, when you think of Jesus, do you think of furniture? Do you? No, I said, you know, he's a bright man, but I think he's off a little here. I said, no, I never think of furniture when I think of Jesus. He said, you don't? What do you think of? I said, I think of somebody that came to show the world what God is like. He said, oh, well, I wonder why you wouldn't think of furniture, because, you know, that was his occupation, carpentry. Oh, no, I know what he did, but what his life more was all about was sharing God. And he said, Carolyn, when people think of you, what do you think that they will think of? Well, he had me. I'm teaching, 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 teaching. I said, I guess they think I was a pretty good teacher. He said, do you want them to think that? I said, oh, no, I'd want them to think of somebody that came to show the world what Jesus is like. He said, well, only you then can change that, either in the way you perform in those teaching times. So, you know how those kind of times drive you to, you know, when you're driving on the freeway and you sort of start daydreaming. Have you ever done this? That you daydream that you're standing right in front of Jesus and looking right in his eyes, and he is saying to you, you know, you're doing a good job. Your students are all going to hell, but you're getting their papers graded before they do. And I thought, you know, I'd like to hear a different message from him. And so I began to notice people. Even though I was very busy, I would notice. And I noticed one day I drove out of the parking lot, the teacher's parking lot, and I taught at a rough school, I would say, sort of a ghetto school. It was the kind where they fired on the teachers in the parking lot. And then I asked the principal, what are we supposed to do if this happens again? And he said, well, if you run zigzag, it's real hard for them to hit you. I saw a student sitting on a curb. I thought she missed her bus, and she may be shot. And so I said, why don't you get in the car, and I'll take you home. And as we were driving toward the projects where she lived, she began to tell me what she did, that she babysat, and then she spent the money for buying food and for the kids in the projects. I said, you know, that's wonderful, Sandra. That reminds me of Jesus, your kindness. And then we had a little funeral silence in the car. Finally, I said, Sandy, do you know who Jesus is? She said, yes, I do. I said, okay. And I let her out. She goes, you mean you didn't finish? You didn't share the bridge or the boat or the hand or the foot? No. I just went fishing. I just planted a seed, threw out the bait. The next week, she came back and stood outside my classroom till the passing periods, and she said, could you come here? She said, you know what? You know, you told me the other day I'm reminded you of Jesus. I went to church Sunday. I'm not anything like Jesus. I said, you're not? Well, you could be. I could how? I said, well, I could show you how. And you know how you think, like, now. And I said, she said, good. I said, when would you like me to do that? He said, some Saturday afternoon. I'm like, okay. But the point is that my life began to change because one person loved me enough to challenge me. And there's some people in this room who've done plenty of that too. But we want to talk about Jesus and how he challenged two people. One was a family member. One was a friend. Let's look at Luke 2, 41 through 52. Mary had a little lamb. His name was Jesus. Actually, if you don't mind, let's don't start with the temple. Let's start with John 2, 1 through 11. Mary was, I don't even know if she had any happening clothes, Carol, but she was awesome, right? The very person that birthed her Savior, who gave birth to the Creator of the world. And I'm not sure that I would have done it exactly like Jesus did. I've had a little public relations, and I think if he had asked me about it, I would have said, you know what I think you need to do is put up a high rise, a big white building, and put a diamond on top that's so big, and it'll just reflect all over the world. And just have Jesus born in there, and don't let anybody else get in there. And people can just come, you know. And instead, what happened? I mean, they're in this stable with these animal droppings, and then they had to place him in that manger with animal slava. I mean, God is way ahead of us, isn't he? Because nobody can ever say, well, one thing about me, I just had a bad start, and Jesus could never relate to me. Excuse me. And can you imagine the angels that were getting ready for this? I'm sure that that choir had practiced and practiced. I'm sure they had that music down perfectly. And probably some group was up there building that choir scaffold for about 100 years. And finally, Gabriel says, "He's born, you're on." And they open the curtains and they look out and they go, "What is this? Six shepherds? Shepherds? Who was in charge of brochures?" I mean, it was not really your big audience. And then when they started running around going, "Hey, Jesus is born, Jesus is born, Jesus is born." I mean, how many little boys was named Jesus in that neighborhood? I'm sure they just keep eating, go, "Oh, another kid named Jesus." And then they go, "Who, by the way, came to tell you that? A shepherd? Oh, shepherds." And by, you know, they had gone into sort of ill repute at that time. They were had little light fingers, stole people. And they go, "Now, who told you that Jesus was born?" "Oh, your friendly local robber." So sometimes his mind is so higher, so much higher than ours, is he not? In the way he thinks. But here we see him with his mother. And if we notice the setting, on the third day there was a wedding at Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited, and his disciples, to the wedding. And when the wine was all gone, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no more wine." Now notice Jesus' statement. Jesus said to her, "Dear woman, what is that to you and to me? What have we in common? Leave it to me. My time, my hour to act is not yet come." I'm reading from the Amplified, which many call the multiple choice version. Now, let's look at what Jesus did. He refused to be a dysfunctional. He was about how old at this time? Around 30 years old. They are at the wedding together. His mother makes a note that there's no more wine and says, "They're out of wine." Instead of, I mean, she just sort of made a suggestion. You know, people like that, they can control by suggestion. And I know she was human. She was awesome, but she was human too. And I think rather than ask him to do the favor, she just suggested, "They're out of wine," which means make it. And he knew that. So, with respect, "Dear woman, no, it is not my time." And I think he might have said, "I think that the time that I go public with my miracles is between God and me, not you and me. How about you don't control when I go public with the miracles? Let's have that between God and me." So he told her the truth. Many people that become dysfunctional in their families will not speak truth. They just deny what they really want, and they let the family usurp their time and their goals. Jesus refused to do that. He did tell his mother the truth with respect. "No, it is not my time." You say, "Yes, but didn't he do it?" Yes, he did. And your guess about why he did that, I guess, is as good as mine. I would think that it was because of his graciousness and his real love to meet a need that his mother sensed. I asked a businessman right before I left, we were going down the elevator together in his building, and I said, "Why do you think Jesus went ahead and made that wine?" He said, "Why did he make it? He made it because they needed it. You know, they needed 180 gallons. You can't just run out and get 180 gallons of wine. He did it because of need." I tend to think he did it out of love and graciousness to his mother. But part of his love was to challenge her suggestion to be honest and open about it. And, of course, I've heard people say that her next statement is the best advice any woman has ever given in the world. And in verse 5 you read, "His mother said to the servants, 'Whatever he says to do, do it.'" I do like that. Whatever he says to do, do it. And he did it. But he did refuse her system. He did let her know, "I know about my timing, and this is not my time." Now, another situation where we see him responding is when they assume he was lost in the temple. So now let's look at Luke 2, 41 through 52. Do you remember that story? His parents went to Jerusalem every year to the Passover feast. And when he was 12, they went up, as was their custom. If you remember what happened, on the way home, what happened? They left Jesus at the temple. And that was his 5 days at the temple. Now, this would be, as is said in The Secrets of Your Family Tree, suppose, how many of you have a 12-year-old boy in here? I mean, not in here, but do any of you have a 12-year-old? Okay, all right. Now, let's suppose that you were out in Los Angeles with your 12-year-old boy, and you started back with your whole group, and you figured he was with Aunt so-and-so or Uncle whatever, and you drove all the way to New Mexico, and then you started looking around. Well, where is Jesus? He's lost. He is not here. I mean, they've driven all the way to New Mexico. Guess what they have to do now? Do you love this as a mother? I got to drive back to L.A. So you go back to L.A. all this time. What is happening in your mother's heart? Great fear for his safety, right? And a bit of anger that he didn't get himself into the position before you left. And so when she finds Jesus, do you remember what she says? Yes, why have you done this to us? See, she's bringing fear and anger to him. Has that ever happened in your home? Has a member of your family ever brought fear and anger to you and said, why have you made me angry? Why have you caused me fear? And Jesus, I don't know if he said, excuse me, but, you know, in the 90s, they'll call me codependent and dysfunctional if I let you do that. Just out of his great wisdom, he did not accept that shame based for himself. He could have said, oh, mother, you're angry. I guess I did make you angry. Oh, I'm so sorry. I made you angry. You were afraid, you didn't really trust in God, and I'm responsible for your lack of trust in God. Oh, I'm so sorry. And you take all of someone else's fear or anger. He didn't do that, did he? What did he do? He said, one moment here while I find the place. How is it that you had to look for me? Suppose Judy was running around for 3 days in L.A. and she getting angrier and angrier. Where is that kid? And maybe that's the way Mary felt in her humanness. Where is that boy? And they finally found him at the temple. And she said what she had to say to him. Why did you treat us like this? Your father would be so anxiously looking for you, distressed. For a minute. He said, how is it you had to look for me? Ladies, have you figured out about your teenagers yet? Have you not smothered them with your dreams to the point that you don't know them? And I think he was trying to say, don't you know me well enough to know where I would be? You know, you just go to your mall, wouldn't you? And go in the music store. And they'll be back there in one of those booths. That's probably where they've spent the whole week, your children. Did you not see and know that it is necessary for me to be in my Father's house? And here he does mention my Father's house. Occupied about my Father's business. At this point he announces, it's my Father. And don't you imagine Jesus had trouble on the playground when people go, hey, Jesus, why don't you favor Joseph? You said who was your father? The Holy Spirit. But he has accepted that God is my Father, and I announced that here. Didn't you know enough about me to know that? And we need to be able to say to people, do you not know me very well? Have I not communicated very well who I am? That's one situation where we see Jesus not accepting a type of accusation that shamed him or blamed him. And may we be able to imitate him in that, and be that in love to other people. Another situation we see him in is Mark 3, 20 through 21. And this is when Jesus went into his public ministry. And again, family systems resist change a great deal. If everyone in your family has been an engineer and your son wants to go into ballet, he is going to have to face a lot of questions and probably a great deal of resistance from his family. Or maybe if everyone's been in ballet and in your family and your daughter wants to go into engineering, she might have a problem from you. So family systems do resist change. And it seems to me that this was Jesus' family's attempt to fix him. They had heard about him, Mark 3, 20 through 21. But a throng came together again so that Jesus and his disciples could not even take food. And when those who belonged to him, his kinsmen, heard it, they went out to take him by force. We are going to fix this. We're going to bring him home. He's so embarrassing. He's acting crazy. For they kept saying, he is out of his mind, besides himself, deranged. Now, I know that some of you think you grew up in a difficult family. Did your mother ever call you crazy? What Jesus' mother did. We have got to fix him. He's acting crazy. And so they said, come on out here. Did he? Did he go running out there? Go, oh, I'm supposed to be the savior of the world, but is this bothering you a little that we're changing our family system? Well, I'll just sit down there and make tables or something. No, he kind of changed his definition of family. Anyone who does what is my family. Anyone who obeys the word is my family. So we see three situations there where Jesus loved this woman, his mother, but he also challenged her with his love so that he didn't become a codependent or a dysfunctional. He was healthy and he was functional. In the same way that he loved his family, challenging them, he also loved this friend of his who, according to John 5:11, was a person that he held in high esteem and loved. And that's Martha. Now, I'd like you for just a minute to think through, maybe you could just jot down out in the margin of, if you're taking notes, if Jesus were going to be at your place for dinner Sunday. Now, Carol, don't get, I don't know if he'll, Gene might not let him come, but if he were going to be there on Sunday, what would your menu be? Would you just write it out? If Jesus were going to have dinner with you Sunday, what would your menu be? Deanne's not right. She's not going to feed him. She's going to take him out. Okay. Did some of you write down your favorite meal that you would serve him? Uh-huh. Not poor. That's a sensitive woman. We're getting ready to look at Luke 10, 38 through 42, where Jesus went, and this home, I don't understand really, but it seems that Jesus did not choose always to go back to his home when he wanted rest and refreshment. He chose to come to this home that belonged to Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And they were in a bustle, weren't they? Have you ever, and evidently Martha felt a little out of control when she was normally in control. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, Alexander, the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days. Have you ever had one of those kind of days where you thought everything was out of control? This guy, I'm going to assume that he's from Australia because he keeps talking about it in here. I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. When I got out of bed, I tripped on my skateboard. By mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink when the water was running, and I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At breakfast, Anthony got a Corvette Stingray car kit in his breakfast cereal box. Nick found a junior undercover agent code ring in his cereal box. But in my cereal box, I found nothing but cereal. I think I'll move back to Australia. In the carpool, Mrs. Gibson let Becky have a seat by the window. Audrey and Elliot got seats by the window, too. I said, I'm being squished. I'm being smushed. I said, if I don't get a seat by the window, I'm going to be car sick. No one even answered. I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At school, Mrs. Dickens liked Paul's picture of the sailboat better than my picture of the invisible castle. At singing time, she said I sang too loud. At counting time, she said I left out 16. Who needs 16? I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I could tell because Paul said I wasn't his best friend anymore. He said Philip Parker was his best friend and Albert was his next best friend. I was only his third best friend. I hope you optimized my marble went down the drain. I had to wear my railroad train pajamas, and I hate railroad train pajamas. When I went to bed, Nick took back the pillow. He said I could have the Mickey Mouse nightlight burned out, and I bit my tongue. The cat wants to sleep with Anthony, not with me. It has been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. My mom says there are some days like that, even in Colorado. I think Martha was having a bad day. Let's look at Luke 10, 38 through 42. Now, while they were on their way, it occurred that Jesus entered a certain village, and a woman named Martha received and welcomed him into her house. People assumed that Martha was a widow. She seemed to be very responsible, and also a woman of some means. And she had a sister named Mary who seated herself at the Lord's feet and was listening to his teaching. But Martha, overoccupied and too busy, was distracted about much serving, and she came up to him and said, Lord, is it nothing to you that my sister's left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. Can you imagine telling Jesus that? Tell her to get up and help me, to lend a hand and do her part along with me. Now, Jesus could have relegated every woman to the brownies at that time, couldn't he? To the kitchen. But the Lord replied to her by saying, Martha, Martha. See, he didn't say, you're wrong, Martha. You're just in a snit. He challenged her who wanted to control him. Jesus, let me tell you what to do. You got this woman sitting in here. I don't know if you know that women are not supposed to learn in the room where men are learning. Tell her to get up and do what she's supposed to do. And Jesus challenged her in a loving way. Martha, I love you, but you know, can I just put my hand on your problem? My finger, excuse me. Your problem is you are distracted. You are worried about this meal. Now just bring the pizza and let's do it. She was in there polishing the silver, fixing a feast. There is a need, only one, and Mary has chosen a good portion, that which is to advantage, which shall not be taken away from her. Now, one thing about Martha, they were great friends. In John 11, 25 and 26, we read that this is where he revealed to her, before anyone else in the world, I am the resurrection and the life. And this woman had great discernment. In John 11, 27, she says, I know it. I know you're the Messiah. I know you're the anointed one. I know you are the Son of God. She knew that, so she had spent time loving him. But, ladies, do you think that it would have been quite an interesting marriage proposal if your husband had said to you one night, taken you out, bought you a rose or whatever he did, had the mariachi band playing for you, and then he said, you know, honey, I need a housekeeper. And I need someone to sew up my clothes, and I need a piano player when I get in a weird mood. I need a chauffeur, should we have children. I need a hostess, so could you marry me? Is that what most of them say? No. They say, I love you, and I want you. I'm tired of taking you home from these dates. I just want to take you home with me forever. And do you like that? Yes. And you marry them, and then you chauffeur their children, and you keep their house. But that's not the intent. And I think Jesus is trying to get her focus in the right place. I think Martha might have been really headed toward being a burnout babe. Because if we look at some of the characteristics of a potential burnout, their work is always well done. The quality of their work is always well done. But you know where they have relationship problems? With people that are closest to them. They also postpone pleasure for higher goals. I would like to come in there and sit and listen to you, Jesus, but get the kid up and have her come in here and help me. I mean, this is a big job. Also, a lot of people in today that are postponing pleasure, they're not making friends. And you know what's going to happen to them? They're going to retire with no activities and no friends. And they're going to sit in their beautiful houses that are paid for with no friends and no activities. We need to check to see, am I in this category? Do I love Jesus, but am I over-occupied with serving him? I mean, I'm talking to myself today. And then, Lord, get Mary to help me. Do we get envious of other people who aren't doing as much as we're doing? I mean, have you ever managed to sit alone for 30 minutes and think, Did any of you do that yesterday? Did you just get out there and sit alone and think and not feel guilty? And then sometimes people headed toward burnout can feel very alone. Why do I do this alone, she says. There is a pressure of a certain lifestyle that we bring on ourselves. And I think Jesus was saying, no, Martha, Martha. Get that one thing straightened out in your life. And I think what he was saying is, your highest calling is to be my disciple. Sit at my feet, not to serve me. But of course, being his disciple draws such love from him that we automatically do that. Now, I don't know what kind of woman you are today. I would wonder if there would be a typical woman of the 90s here who would stand up and say, yeah, I'm carrying a lot of baggage. I do tend toward control. I don't know if we have such a woman in our midst. Like a Nina 90s.
Oh, Nina 90s. Oh. Nina, I know you. You're careless.
Yes. Well, Nina, you have changed your dress a great deal. I mean, I remember you've got on more, weird things than you used to wear. What is that box of Kleenex? What is that?
Oh, well, you know,
it looks like, I mean, if somebody just looked at that, they'd think you had pity pockets or something.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I go through one of these boxes every single day, and you know, I have to feel sorry for myself. I have a lot of woes in my life. I mean, things don't go right. People don't appreciate me. I work so hard trying to get them all in line and make things work. They don't even thank me. And so if I don't feel sorry for myself, nobody will.
But you know what, Nina, 90s, I think one of the things you might want to do is try to turn those pockets of pity into compassion for other people.
You mean I wouldn't get to carry my Kleenexes anymore?
Oh, you could carry them, but they'd be for a different purpose. Let me just hold that, though, for a minute while you think about that.
You want me to give this to you?
That's right.
Well, could I have it back later?
We'll think about it. Now, I notice you have some beads that don't really match your outfit. What are those?
They don't match. These are my beads of bitterness. I am so bitter about things, and I seeds on to remember all those rotten things people have done to me. You know, my parents, they made me the way I am.
You know what, Nina? I think that if you really are overcome by the challenge of Jesus' love for you, you're going to have to take those beads off.
Okay, Carolyn, I've been wearing these beads for 10 years.
Well, consider that, Judy. And I don't know. I think you're going to put that book down. What is that book you're carrying? It's big. You used to carry the Bible in your heart and in your hand. What is that?
Every day. I don't know if you can see, but I have highlighted in here all the people who've offended me. And I like to review it every day. So I don't forget. Who said me wrong?
So that really makes your beads of bitterness hang on more, huh?
Yeah. We kind of work together.
You know, Judy, I would encourage you. Excuse me, Nina. This is Judy Bragdon from Wichita, Kansas, by the way. Okay, now in the 90s, I think that's another point where Jesus' love would challenge you. Either give that book up or turn it into your prayer book and forgive those people and begin to pray for their good.
Well, I'll let you hold it, but I'm not giving it to you.
Okay. And what about that coat? Why are you wearing that coat? Isn't that a little hot in here?
Well, this is my code of cares. And I got lots of things to worry about. You know, this world is wicked and there's terrible things happening, and if I don't worry about it, who will? So I gotta wear my code of cares.
Do you ever let someone help you with that?
No, I do it better than most anybody I know. Don't worry.
Have you ever read where Jesus said, "Cast all your cares on me"? Yeah. Well, why don't you take that coat off for a minute and let me just hold it while you think about it. And I've noticed that you've got on your loafers of long-range planning there.
Yeah. See? Yeah. I have to plan way out in advance to get this world the way I want it to be. I like to try and have things in control. You know? So I wear these loafers every day, too.
Mm-hmm.
They do match my beads.
Yeah. And so they carry you in all directions, doing all kinds of things.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And people follow me when I wear these loafers.
Well, I think it's good that you're responsible, Judy, but I think you need to check the direction of your life. And I think Jesus loving you would allow you to do that. Now, I think he would love for you to change or just take all this off. Because before you put on the kind of love he shows, you're going to have to take off some things.
You know, Carolyn, I think I'm going to take these things back from you. I'll think about what you said. But, you know, you're asking me to give up some baggage that's very dear to me. So I'll think about it.
Okay, Nina. Ladies, Nina, 90s, has a decision to make about what baggage she takes out of her life. And you know what? So do you and I. How do we do that best? And I have four pegs that I think you can hang that on. And they are, if you're taking notes, Bush, baking, basketball, best copy.
Pretty non-biblical, huh?
We need to know the person in charge. And in case we didn't know whether he was in charge or not until the war, now we do. But you can hear people say many strange things about this man who's in charge of a country. You can hear people say even stranger things about God. But we will never learn how to accept the love that Jesus offers to women until we're able to know him. Now, and by know him, what's the difference in facts about him and really genuinely knowing him. What? Yeah, one is from the head, the other is from the heart. For instance, if I said, I'm going to get to know, what is your first name?
Susan,
okay. Susan, how tall are you?
5'3".
5'3". Where do you work?
In Memphis, in a church.
And do you have a family?
No.
What are you doing here at this conference?
Listening to you.
Now, would you say, well, I think I pretty well know it. Now, what color are your eyes?
Brown.
Mm-hmm. And are you satisfied with your paycheck?
Relatively.
All right. So I know a lot of facts about this woman, don't I? That's it, man. I know her. Do I? No. Facts about God will never allow us to really know him. We need a relationship. Jeremiah 9:22-23 says, you know, if you want to brag about anything, you ought to brag about knowing me. And Winston Churchill, see, I could maybe become an expert on Winston Churchill, but I could never know him. You can become an expert on God and never know him. But the desire is to have a relationship with him, know him. See, George Washington Carver, I heard Louis Giglio tell this, he was evidently a very spiritual man, and at one point he prayed. He would ask God questions and then seek his answer. And he said, God, could you tell me everything there is to know about you? And he said that in modern terms, God said, get a grip, George. I mean, you can't live long enough for me to tell you everything there is to know about me. So George Carver tried another angle. He said, well, God, how about if you could just tell me everything about how you made the world? And then as he thought about that, he thought, well, you know, I could go out and buy one of those $34.95 books, and I could find out about how God made the world. But I want God to tell me something. So he went back to God, and he said, God, how about the peanut? Could you tell me everything there is to know about the peanut? And do you know that he's the only man who ever had 250 patents on the peanut? And just about everything we know about the peanut came from George Carver. Would it be wonderful someday for us to be able to say that we know God enough to talk to him, to ask him questions, to get him to get into a position so we could hear him. To do that, we've got to know him. And that means spending time with him or having a plan. If you bake without a plan, have you ever had your son go in the kitchen and say, I have this new girlfriend. She loves cherry pie. I'm going to make one. And so you see him in there and he's doing all kinds of things. And when he comes out, well, you have to go back with the water hose and fix your kitchen up. And you say, well, son, where's your cherry pie? I couldn't get it together. But he goes back in the next night and he tries again. Then you have to repaint your kitchen. But he still doesn't have a cherry pie. If he keeps on failing, what's he going to do? He's going to give up. And we can attempt to know God, but if we don't have any plan, we're eventually going to give up. I remember a person that approached me when I first decided to get very serious about God, and she showed me this. She put a glass down and drew a little circle, and she showed me the wheel. And then I was trying to reproduce that in my life and everybody else's life that I met, until I met Helene Asker, and then she showed me the flower, which made a lot better sense to women. And if you don't know what the flower is, ask Helene. She'll be here through the week. But it's like, okay, the flower is this supposed to be planted in the love of God, Ephesians 3:17. And then the stem is Jesus, keeping Jesus in the center of our lives. Have you ever pulled a stem out of a flower and had it last? No. But what are you really interested in a flower? Then the leaves would be, whoops, we don't have enough, but okay, we'll just do the word and prayer and evangelism, or fellowship and evangelism. Okay. Now, normally, when you go to pick out a flower, do you go into the florist and go, listen, I came down here because I heard you've had great leaves. Do you do that? Or when somebody gives you a flower, you go, just give me a minute with these leaves. No, we don't do that. We don't care about the leaves. I mean, they make it pretty. We don't care. What are we looking for? The blossom. And the blossom is like Galatians 5:22 and 23. Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness. That's what the world loves. So we need some kind of plan to go after that. The basics. And then we need basketball is practice. Now, can you imagine if at one day you decide, okay, I'm gonna go to a bunch of basketball conferences, and I'm going to read books on basketball. I'm going to find out some autobiographies of people that play basketball. I'm going to write a 25-page paper on basketball. I'm going to go every Sunday and sit and listen for about an hour on basketball. Maybe I'll even go out to Colorado and have a whole week conference on basketball. And then I'm going to go to the Olympics and ask them to give me a suit. Would they do it? No. Because to play basketball, what do you have to do? Practice. You got to practice. And if we're really going to know God, we got to practice things that are important to Him, like evangelism, like teamwork. Ephesians 5:11-14 says we need to be trained by practice. Now, I was flying from Oklahoma City to Denver with several cadets were on there. And so I was trying to think, now let's see, this cadet, how could I share Christ with him? How could I just throw out? And so I said, you know, it's been very interesting listening to you. He was the leader of this group of cadets that was on. And I said, I just want to ask you a question. Do you remember the year that Reagan was shot? And he goes, yes, 1985. I mean, they have all these facts. And I said, well, suppose that Gaddafi should have called Ronald Reagan and said, I have George Bush here, and I'm going to torture him. No, if you don't send me your son and let me torture him for 1 week, you'll never see George Bush again. That's one scenario. I don't know what you think that Ronald Reagan would do, but suppose that Gaddafi called him and said, I have John Hinckley here, the man who shot you, and if you don't send me your son to be tortured for 1 week, you'll never see John Hinckley again. I said, now, do you think he'd just hang up? He said, no, actually, if he were a man in charge, he would not have the freedom just to hang up. He would have to deal with all those lives to save them. I said, you know, that reminds me a great deal of God. He said, who? God. Oh, well, whatever. Now, was I through fishing? Yeah, that was enough. But at least I know, well, have to work on that. I don't know, you know, next time a cadet sits down by me, I might have another idea. But we need to always be practicing, and practicing being a part of a team. It's hard to be a part of a team, isn't it? It's hard. We have to practice that, giving up our own ideas. And then best coffee. Part of our plan is to be Christ-like, to demonstrate to the world what Jesus is like. And part of that would be in loving the world. There was one situation that I was living in. In fact, Priscilla Fleming Sparks was in that same apartment complex. And our attempt was to reach out to post-collegiates. And in the process, we had parties and we had evangelistic studies, and this one young man named Mike came to those evangelistic studies and asked hundreds of questions. And at the end of the studies, he stood up and said, thank you very much. I'd still like to be an atheist.
So we said, okay. But you're still our friend, Mike, and we still want you to come and have cookies, whatever. Okay. At that same time, there was one young man, I think he's now with Willow Creek Church in Chicago, who said, you know, we have a brain-damaged child, a family in our church has a brain-damaged child. There are 12 of us out here in this complex. If we would volunteer every Saturday to keep that child, we'd only have to do it once every 3 months. Yes, good idea. So we did that, and every Saturday, one of us had that child over there. And Mike, our friend, who is an atheist, he said, you know, that kid y'all bring over here is a creep. Have you noticed that? He is a creep. No, he's not a creep, Mike. We love him. We love his family. We love him. And he watched this week after week, and he would say in the middle of the week, you bringing that weird kid over here next Saturday? Yes. We love him. Then one day, Mike was going for a bike ride, and he pedaled by the patio, and somebody was playing with Brian, and he got out toward the end, and then he turned around, pedaled back to his apartment, and he told us this later. He parked his bike, and he took his keys, opened his apartment, and he threw them just as far as he could throw them, and then he sat down, and he said, God, do you see that out there? They love each other, and they love that weird kid. If you will give me that kind of love, I'll do what you said, and I'll give you my life. Ladies, Jesus is loving us, whether it's in a tender way or a tough way. The world is waiting to see us love each other. John 17:23 says, if we will love each other, the world will know that Jesus came. Let's show it.